This is Cave Scott Allen of OJCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on January 28th, 2013. Today we're talking to Amir Rajan about Oak and maybe some of his other cool open source projects. Amir works at Improving Enterprises. And Amir, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I've been developing, I guess, since 2007. That's when I graduated from college and just went right into .NET. And from there on out, you know, just really never looked back. I was doing VB6 first, and then I did COM to .NET conversions and then VB.NET to C# conversions, and then from there to web. So I've been with Improving for almost 3 years now, and we're just a consulting company based out of Dallas.
Okay.
And really like coding, and I have a lot of repos on GitHub.
Yeah, I noticed. Okay, so let's dive right in. Let's talk about Oak. Can you give us the high level, you know, what is Oak?
So Oak is basically my approach to making single page applications that are heavy on JavaScript. And it really takes a lot from the Ruby and Rails community as far as their feedback loops and kind of a lot of their goodness that they've done with their web development lifecycle. And I've brought that into .NET.
So I thought I'd actually start with that, because in looking at your screencasts, I mean, there's a lot of the kind of nuts and bolts of how things fit together. But what really kind of got my attention was the development workflow. So you've got your first screencast shows working with, you know, with Oak, but also you're using NSpec, SpecWatcher, Canopy, some other things to kind of get and Growl to get some like rapid feedback as you're developing.
Yeah, it was just when I started working with Rails, that's kind of what I saw, was that I'd make a change and immediately get that feedback. So it made, you know, working with Dynamic a lot easier, and just working without a compiler, working without type safety. And I just saw a lot of these things that you would make a change and immediately see that update come up. And before I started doing Rails, I couldn't understand how a Rails developer could just use Vim or just a really simple text editor and get that kind of feedback. And when I started seeing that they use simple file watchers, that's what SpecWatcher is, to try to get as much information about how the app is performing, what's like getting sent to your web server, what's getting returned. I just wanted to capture that and bring that over to .NET. And that's pretty much what SpecWatcher and NSpec, all those things come together, actually do. So the general concept is really, it's really simple. When you save a file, something happens. So SpecWatcher, all it really does, it looks at what file has been saved and then perform some action based on that file. So if it ends up being like a CoffeeScript file, it could compile down to JavaScript, or you can enhance it to say if it was like a JPEG, maybe you could spriteify that. Or if it's a CS file, then run tests. And this concept of just saving a file and then have your backend or your little assistant just do something for you made a lot of sense after I saw how the Rails community did it.
Okay, and then you've got Growl also hooked up that's going to pop up that feedback then?
Yep, and some people don't like Growl, and it always shows up on the console output, so you can always disable Growl and just have your second monitor show that feedback. And, it, you know, that really goes against, I guess, most plugins. A lot of what I see in .NET is it's a plugin into Visual Studio, and I took a different approach to it, and I've been pretty happy with what I've seen, primarily because it's not anything compiled. I know Mighty Moose has that feedback loop, so does nCrunch, but those are all compiled artifacts. So it's hard to scale that or expand that as your solution grows. And that's something that I saw the other communities doing really well.
Okay, so let's talk about the flow of building a new application. You do file, new project, and then what?
So that's the crazy thing. You don't even do that. You go into the command line and run a script called warmup. And what that does is it brings down a Visual Studio template from GitHub and brings down the Oak template.
Okay, now so, warmup is using, that's Rob Reynolds' thing from the...
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep, warmup is it's basically, it's a really nice story to get a solution template up and going. So I just upload two solution templates online. You run warmup from the command line. It will create the solution for you with Oak already installed. It will have the unit testing in there, your rake file, all that will be precompiled. And then that's really you can open up the solution. And what happens is as soon as you open up the solution and run a rake test to start the server, you'll get an interactive tutorial that takes you through the rest of Oak.
Okay, and I think we've talked about rake at least in passing on some previous shows, but what's involved in setting up rake?
So Rake is Ruby Make. You have to have Ruby installed. But that's really it. After that, there's a Rake scripts that are already included that encapsulate MS Build and some nice tasks like resetting the database, regenerating the schema, deploying your app to like a local directory that IIS Express can point to. So it's a lot of these developer commands that are pre-built and brought down with Oak. So when you start up an Oak application, you run your warm-up script, which creates your solution, Rake, and then typing the command Rake builds your application and deploys to like a CINET pub, and then running Rake server starts up IIS Express against that instance.
Okay. And then one big obvious thing, and you mentioned as kind of part of the tagline here, is that Dynamics, it really kind of leverages Dynamics. So how different is that from, say, somebody that's used to ASP.NET MVC or other kind of more traditional non-dynamic C# development?
So the great thing is that Oak just augments what's already there in ASP.NET MVC. So Oak actually has a couple of model binders that takes an HTTP request and makes it a dynamic object. And kind of allows you to take that dynamic object and insert it directly into a database or decorate that object to add validation or change tracking or what have you. So as far as the progression or the evolution of using dynamic, the model binders are already built in. So when you declare a HTTP post that takes in a dynamic argument, the model binder picks up and it treats your HTTP request or your form collection as a dynamic object. And then it opens you up to using one of the core dynamic constructs that I built called Gemini, and that's where a lot of the magic occurs. And you know, we can go into a little bit more detail on that if you want.
Yeah, but, sure. So is Gemini a separate, you know, thing? Could I use Gemini without Oak, or is it really just kind of built in? Okay.
No, yeah, it's a separate NuGet package. Each one of these things is kind of built up, so you can just have a small piece of Oak if you don't want to install the entire thing. But it's a separate NuGet package that gives your solution dynamic capabilities. And what I found out with using dynamic was that you'll find when you create a Oak solution, it doesn't have an IOC container or any kind of dependency inversion or a mocking framework. In fact, the reason is that because of the dynamic capabilities you get in your classes, you're able to redefine methods or tack on behavior without needing those kind of constructs. And that was a real eye opener for me when I started doing dynamic programming.
So I'm not completely clear on what Oak, or excuse me, what Gemini adds in. Like, how exactly does that just packages up the dynamic? Like, could I use it in a console app? And if so, what's it doing for me?
So what Gemini does is it inherits from dynamic object, and it basically opens up your class to be to have behavior attached to it on the fly. So you can, you know, in JavaScript you can add a property onto an object similar to what you get with expando object. But what it additionally applies is a concept of being able to mix in modules. So you can create a class that takes in a dynamic object as a constructor parameter, and that class could attach methods and properties to a object that inherits from Gemini. So the idea there is that if I want to add validation to an object, it doesn't have to necessarily implement an interface or inherit from validation or anything like that. It can actually get it can have a module mixed in. That's the general term that I use, is a mix-in, and gain that capability without the need for inheritance or an IOC container or any kind of IO weaving like PostSharp does or anything like that.
Okay.
So an example would be with validations. If I want, I can create a typeless object that uses Gemini and say add validation to this construct, and it will get validation behavior. It'll have new methods added to it, like is valid, validates, has errors, first error, some of those all those methods, and those get applied dynamically.
Okay, that makes sense. So I think I distracted you off of describing how dynamic works in Oak in general then.
Right. So the way dynamic works in Oak is that it provides you, Gemini is kind of the foundation for your dynamic types. It really opens up your object model in a very, very jarring way for someone that's coming from a statically typed language. But what you'll find is that you won't need things like dependency injection or mocking, because you can actually add methods on the fly, and when it comes time to test, redefine those methods. So the general idea is that you have something that inherits from Gemini, and then somewhere else you define additional capabilities that object has. So you can say that this person object has validation capabilities that can save to the database, and it has change tracking. And then you can create these modules to add additional behavior to your objects without needing inheritance. And the core concepts in Oak are built upon this idea of being able to decorate your object as it moves through the different layers, like your data access or your controllers.
So does Oak? It sounds like it has the beginnings of like a pipeline process. So you could put different handlers in front of your page, or is all this kind of composition going on kind of behind the scenes, or you know, just from the app point of view, or so, whatever it takes to yeah.
Yeah, it's go a, ahead. It pretty much is like that. I guess a real good example that I've used in the past is let's say I want to return a JSON payload to my front end. I like to include links on my JSON payload that say, hey, if you want to save yourself, then you know you can route to this URL. And what I've had to do in the past was I'd have to create a view model or a POCO that would have save URL or delete URL and then construct that inside of my controller. So this way, what happens is that as the object comes out of the database and makes it to the controller, that object is something that's prototypical. So I can further decorate that with URL routing inside of the controller without having to create additional view models or any additional POCOs. So that's where that decoration, or as it moves to the layers, you can add additional features to it.
It sounds like this kind of completes some things that were already sort of there. Like there was already some dynamic support in MVC. There's the view bag is a dynamic object, but there's just kind of it's kind of a start of something, but it's not really like built out. Whereas it sounds like you've kind of continued to build that out.
Yes, that's correct. And a lot of people have been using expando objects as kind of like. Get your feet wet. This is how you can do some dynamic capabilities. But what Gemini brings to the table is the ability to call method missing. So it borrows from that from the concept of Ruby to be able to call a method on an object, and if that method doesn't exist, actually have your objects add that method on the fly. So an example would be, let's say if I wanted to scrub my HTML and do URL encoding for all my properties, I could say if I had a first name property, I could call a method first name HTML. And that can invoke method missing on the object that received that method call. And it could actually parse the method name and determine what to do with that. So you get a lot of really interesting capabilities using this augmentation of dynamic. But you're right. It's just that next step. We're already doing it. We just haven't, you know, invested it all the way through.
Now, this reminds me a little bit of Clay. Gemini does it with that method missing. Clay was something that Louis Desjardins did on the, I think it was for use in Orchard. Have you looked at that?
I haven't.
Okay.
I know Orchard had basically an ORM where you just give it you can query a table directly and you would get back a dynamic object, if that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So then, I mean, we're talking a little bit about entities and validation and stuff. So you have, it's a Cambium? Is that?
Yep.
And so that's the entity model part of this then, right?
Yes, that's an entity model. And, you know, talking through this, it sounds like there's a lot of code here, but you're probably looking at about 4,000 lines of code for this. And that's including the ORM. It uses I did an augmentation of Massive, what Rob Connery built out. So I liked the dynamic ORM that he already had in place, and then I augmented it with a knowing about how to work with Gemini and how to do a lot of these associations. So you're looking at about 4,000 lines of code for all the classes that are there, and that includes the JSON serialization, includes the model binders, the ORM validation all the way through. So, I mean, if you compare that to, let's say, in Hibernate, which has probably 60,000 lines of code, I think, for just the ORM itself, it's a really small framer for what it does.
I was wondering if you had taken a look at breeze.js. We did a podcast a couple of thousand years ago, I think, with Ward Bell. It was probably 2 months ago, but it seems longer because of the holidays.
So from what I remember about I've only looked at it briefly, but Breeze allows you to basically craft queries directly in JavaScript, and those get returned back. Is that correct?
Well, not quite. It's kind of like a EF for JavaScript, in that it handles all the change tracking and, you know, is this dirty and does it need to be updated, saved, and all that kind of point, I was wondering if you had looked at interspersing that, or not interspersing, but putting that in with Oak on the client side.
I definitely think that would be something. I need to look at that. A lot of what I've done right now is basically taking, you know, just using ASP MVC's JSON serialization and then returning that back out, and just using standard controllers. But I haven't thought about using something like Breeze to enhance that. Another thing that's on my list to do is integration with Dapper, and also NoSQL ORMs to try to give you that dynamic capability there. But I haven't looked at Breeze outside of that.
So I'll go ahead and ask the silly question, which is, you're bringing a lot of Rails-inspired, Ruby-inspired dynamic stuff to .NET. Why bother? Why not just
Why bother? Why not just do Rails, right? I've gotten that question quite a few times also. And the best thing I can say there is that I do borrow a lot of things from Rails. But one thing that I'm really trying to bring to the .NET stack is not necessarily dynamic, but the idea of frictionless development. We spend a lot of time just dealing with shortcut keys and Visual Studio, trying to rebuild F5 breakpoints, stop the debugger when I want to make changes. A lot of that gets in the way. And so while the introducing of dynamic is a means to an end, and that end is frictionless development. So I think Rails and Ruby brings a lot of good things to the table, but we have a lot of .NET code out there and a lot of .NET apps, and there's an inherent benefit to maybe having a hybrid approach that's both statically typed and dynamic. We're already taking advantage of type inference in C#. We're already doing functional programming. We're now going to do parallel or task-based programming. So all these things are benefiting the language as a whole. So we just haven't given enough attention to dynamic, and I think Oak brings that to the table.
One thing you're pointing out there is that, you know, Visual Studio-based development has always had kind of two modes. There's like code writing mode, you know, and then there's runtime mode. And so you're switching between the two, and what you're saying here is, as you're writing, it's compiling, it's doing all the, you know, whatever, and it's giving you that continuous feedback, but you're never actually hitting F5 and running your application, because it's being built and the tests are run and everything just as you work.
Yeah, and that's what I really try to capture is when I'm building my websites, I try to think about every time that I've had to hit the debugger or hit a breakpoint, and try to make it to where I didn't have to do that. A lot of what I've done with Oak also is augmenting the IIS Express output window. So when you run Rake Server in IIS Express, what you end up seeing there is when you start creating HTTP requests, you'll actually see the JSON payload coming over. You'll actually see SQL statements that are being executed on your backend show up inside of that window. So it makes it really easy to see what your app is doing at any point in time through an HTTP request. Another thing that I ended up adding was the ability to test the system in a load balance environment. So Nginx is really, really good for that. So I ended up bringing that down and making that part of Oak itself. So you can actually run a rake test to simulate a round and robin load balance environment that points to two instances of IIS Express and see how your app runs in that situation. So there's all those different things that I don't know if we've just decided that Visual Studio is the best that can get, but we've just overlooked and we've accepted that, you know, we just have to debug into these things or hit a breakpoint to see what's actually happening when we can use these console outputs to really see what's going on.
Okay. And then, so we talked some about Cambium. Am I saying it right? Cambium?
Yeah, Cambium.
You said that it's based on Massive, and we talked about some things like adding on validation because of dynamic, you're doing a mix-in to pull that in.
Right.
One other thing that I saw is that it's got change tracking support.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something that was in Massive, or is that something you added in?
That's something that I added, and it's not necessarily database change tracking, it's just more property change tracking. So at any point in time, you can see the history of a property and how it's progressed through, you know, being set or reset. And the really interesting thing about all these capabilities, validation, change tracking, and then associations, is that they're all separate modules. So from an API standpoint or a user standpoint, it looks like you're dealing with one object, but there's actually separate objects that are coming together to provide you that capability. But change tracking was something that I added on top of Massive.
Okay. How do you work with some, like, do you have any kind of migration sort of support, or, you know, as I'm working and I'm changing my entity, how does that get folded into the existing database?
So the crazy thing about the way migration works, so there is a migration piece, it's called Seed, And again, it's integrated into Rake, so you can run your migration scripts on the fly. I think, John, you sent out a tweet about how Entity Framework seek configuration, you couldn't call it on the fly, or you had to delete your database to try to reset it.
Yeah, there's some things where you can get yourself kind of in a corner a little bit.
Right. So that's one thing that the schema generation that I've provided gives you. You can actually call Rake reset, which will reset your schema. Rake sample will generate your sample data. And the way the schema generation works is actually database first. The premise being there is that you're not really creating any POCOs. You can actually just create your schema and then return a typeless object back that represents that record. And only when you want to opt into having additional behavior like validation or change tracking or relationships, do you actually have to create a type, a real type. So that was something that I had to kind of figure out, is that you generate your schema. And then from there, when you request, I want records from this table, you get a typeless object that represents the tables. And the DSL is really simple. You just create your SQL types. You say that this column is of this type and is nullable or has default values. And it's just a very lightweight DSL that actually generates a SQL output. And that was one thing that I always struggled with, was with Rails development, they have a concept of migrating your schema, which would execute in your production environment. At least where I've worked, I get a lot of friction from executing C# code that upgrades my schema. Most of the DBAs that I've worked with, they want the SQL that allows them to upgrade it. So I wanted to make sure to adhere to that scenario first. So there's tasks that allow you to export your schema or your migration, and then you can apply those to your production environment or whatever environment that you want.
Okay, so one thing you mentioned earlier was kind of like a benefit of dynamic on the server is that it can work well with dynamic on the client, and it's more similar to JavaScript or JSON on the client. What's the single page application story?
Yeah, so the great thing there is that in a single page application, at least what I've done in the past without using dynamic was I would get a JSON payload that would post to the server. Usually that JSON payload would have some issues with like date times and not converting correctly. So I'd create a view model that would be specific to accepting that JSON payload. And then I would take that view model and use AutoMapper to map it to my entity model. And then I would use the entity model to save to my database. And then if I need to return something, I would create another view model that would represent what I want to return back to the website and then return that as JSON. And you have to create your own entity models for returning back, because your entity framework model or your N Hibernate model might have circular references to other tables, which breaks serialization. And I just got tired of all those aspects of the system. So the story that the proposition that Oak brings to the table is that when you post a JSON payload, you get a dynamic object that can be saved directly to the database. And when you return an object from the database, it can get serialized without worrying about serialization issues and get converted directly to JSON. So the serialization mechanism that I have in place does a breath-first output of properties. So you don't get into this issue of, and it can detect circular references and give you a JSON payload that actually makes sense. So for a single-page application, that's kind of how my applications start up. And then when it's time to evolve, when I want to actually say, I need to add validation to this JSON payload that's coming over the wire, that's when, I'll start bringing in Cambium and adding this additional validation behavior to the system. So it's just a lot of ceremony that goes away when you start using dynamic types that are compatible with your JSON objects.
Someone was mentioning that, was it on Twitter today or Reddit or something, that there's a severe deficit in migration options in the .NET area. I mean, you've kind of got EF migrations, but those are not too bad, I guess. But even there was a Fluent Migrator, which still has some limitations. And and of course, there's EF, and there's some other kind of third-party ones out there. And I was wondering why you think that it's so hard to migrate schemas in .NET, because that was like the first thing that they had in Rails was the schema migration.
I think the real issue is that we're trying to do code first, and we're trying to say that these static types somehow magically map to our database. And while for the easy cases that makes sense, I just don't know how well that turns out. You'll have an NED framework code first that has a relation to a customer table. Is that a many-to-many relationship? Is that a one-to-many relationship? And then you try to create all these class overrides to provide that. So I think we're just taking the wrong approach. I think Fluent Migrator has a good idea of just saying, just generate the schema, you know, using a DSL that makes sense with SQL, and then have your objects hydrate or your ORM try to map to those tables. I think that's the right approach. Another issue is I think it's primarily because .NET is used more in a corporate environment, so there's a lot of gotchas as far as we can't use Fluent Migrator on our database because it's C# code and we just don't trust it. So there's, you know, different concerns in that. And at the end of the day, I think having SQL scripts is probably the best way to approach that. The code first aspect and having POCOs that guess at what your schema should be, I think that's where we're heading in the wrong direction. With Rails, they take that approach too. They don't take necessarily a model first. You create a migration script that says, I have these columns and they're of this type, and it generates the SQL for you. So even in Rails, they don't technically take a model first approach to it. And I think they did it right from that standpoint.
So then as we're talking through kind of the difference in migration story or whatever, I'm thinking we've been talking about the development story. So let's say now you've got, you know, how does the first deployment and the update kind of work? You're deploying code. It's just you're building, you know, .NET code that you deploy, and then SQL scripts are run, you know, probably by DBA or whatever.
Right.
Okay. So deployment is SQL scripts to create the database, and then standard, you know, deploy to IIS style deployment.
Yep, and then that'll be an X, and that's where Rake comes into play too. Is that you can start right now the Rake scripts that are built in deploy to a local directory, but this gives you a point for evolution, right? So if that's something that you can actually use your Rake scripts to integrate with your CI environment to actually deploy to production, you know, that's great. There's Rake scripts to actually create the SQL itself too, so you can use that to actually generate the SQL scripts to execute against your production database or give to a DBA to execute. But it's about positioning yourself to do a lot of these things. But yeah, it's as simple as that. And there's Rake scripts that are already in there that kind of springboard you into allowing you to customize that stuff.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about the single page application thing. I think you have one sample that uses like Angular. I'm curious about like how is it generally kind of like, you know, you've got the standard MVC style for request, get back some HTML and standard page request. And then for single page interactions, you know, you can call back into service code. How do AJAX interactions work?
So the good thing is that everything's seamless. The application you're talking about is called TaskRabbits. It actually shows Backbone, Knockout, and Angular side by side. So you can kind of see how each one of those single page app or those MVC frameworks, JavaScript MVC frameworks, interacts with Oak. And it works itself out really well. For Angular, the HTTP service that they have in play does do a JSON post. The dynamic model binders that exist with Oak can just take that in, and you'll get a nice object that you can, you know, work with. Same thing with Backbone, and if you're doing plain Jane jQuery, all that comes over really nicely. You'll find that for each one of the implementations, it's the same backend. So the front end, you can have Backbone, Knockout, or Angular, and they can all talk to the same REST API. And what I've noticed is that with the implementation of these three applications, the Razor that I serve up is just plain HTML. I don't really use Razor templating at all, and I use the JavaScript templating. Either, you know, Knockout has its own templating, Angular has its own templating, and then I use a jQuery temple or underscore templating with Backbone. So that's another an evolution that I'm seeing with web applications, is that we're relying less and less on server-side rendering of HTML. What do you think about that? Is that a trend that you're seeing also? Or
yes, and that's primarily for a long time there was the whole, yeah, render the HTML server-side and then return it from the AJAX call and then insert it in the DOM, which was a huge, you know, kind of waste of time, and it spread out the templating language all over the place. And I think that as people start to use JavaScript more, they realize, oh yeah, I can actually just, it's easier to write my template language down here using all these template libraries than it is to, you know, have the Razor view engine parse something and send down, you know, the JavaScript, because it usually end up meaning getting the data twice. You send it down, then you got to call back to get the HTML rendered, which means it's got to go to the database and get the values again, re-render the Razor page or the web form page, and then send down the resultant string.
Yeah, and you get parity issues too if you try to load some of the things through Razor first and then go in and add some asynchronous behavior afterwards. you'll be mentioning that template in almost two places every time. So what I found is that having a real simple, really lightweight page that comes over the wire, and then serving up a lot of JSON that can be bound to on the client side in whatever templating engine you want.
Then you're using the same style of controllers to do both the HTML requests and the REST requests, right? The serving up JSON or whatever. It's the same controller with different action methods or whatever.
So for my controllers, I actually have one control that serves up the page, and then the rest of the controls are REST APIs. So they just serve up JSON. So I don't actually have a HTML version of like a task view or anything. It's just serving up JSON.
Okay. So your first request is getting the HTML, which is mostly like the shell, and then that's going to the JavaScript calls back and does all the actual getting of data and rendering and templating.
Yeah, it does the document ready and then fires off however many requests needed to mash up the page.
Okay.
And one thing I've noticed with that approach is that the ORM that you start using has less need for any kind of state. So I know NAD Framework and Hibernate are stateful ORMs. Massive, Dapper, Cambium, which is built upon Massive, are essentially stateless. And with such a small running request, you find that you don't really miss the stateful nature of your ORMs. And I think that's just another side effect to doing single-page applications
mm-hmm.
that we haven't taken a full advantage of.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch. As Scott Kuhn was saying earlier, we just talked to WordBell about Breeze, and it's interesting to watch like the way that web architecture and development is changing as more and more is happening on the client, and we're assuming that. So it used to be kind of like, yeah, let's add on a little bit of interaction, and then it's like, well, let's do both client and server interaction, and now it's really turning the server more and more into a JSON server.
That just serves up JSON, yeah. Yep, and that's what I've been seeing, and then it becomes more of a question of how can you make your backend more amicable to prototypical languages or things like JavaScript, and that's kind of what I've ended up pulling off.
Okay, so in order to make this all work, there's definitely a focus on testing. You talked about InSpec and SpecWatcher. Another thing you're using is Canopy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe how that's used?
So Canopy is actually a UI automation. So I've done a lot of JavaScript work where I'm currently at, and we have probably about 5,000 lines of knockout, which is a whole lot of JavaScript.
Yeah.
And we've tried using Jasmine BDD for our front end testing. We found that a lot of our issues that we were coming up with was specific to DOM manipulation or how the DOM interacted with knockout and observables and everything. So we have to fall back to UI automation. And Canopy is a lightweight DSL over Selenium. And Selenium is a UI automation framework. The biggest issue with Selenium is that it doesn't have any stabilization layers. So when you say, does this div exist, it will immediately fail. Which not necessarily a great thing when you have asynchronous calls coming in and things eventually coming onto the page. So what Canopy provides is it's a stabilization layer on top of Selenium that when you request to say, does this div exist, it will actually try multiple times to find the div. It will, you know, wait a specific number of timeouts before actually throwing an exception or failing a test. Same thing with clicking buttons or typing in the text boxes. It's that nice layer there that protects you from having to deal with Selenium, raw Selenium. Now, the crazy thing about it with Canopy is that it's built in F#. And at first, it may sound like, okay, we've got Ruby, we've got C#, we got to have F# in this solution also, right? But F# ends up being a really good DSL. What I found with UI automation when I did UI automation with C# is I would have this static class that would hold all these operations that I could do against the UI, like click a button or write into a text box. And with F#, because functions are first-class citizens, you don't necessarily have to create any kind of class. So you can just have really simple functions that provide higher-level things like login or delete email or save email, just certain scenarios. So that made F# a really good choice for doing the UI automation.
So I was looking it over, and I was wondering if you had heard of the Owen project and if you considered getting Oak to run on top of Owen and Katana and that whole shebang.
So I haven't looked at Owen or Katana. I know for ServiceStack and for Nancy, those are two projects that are definitely in my radar, just being able to add this dynamic runtime to REST APIs like that. But I haven't looked at Owen or WCF Web API or ASP.NET Web API too much.
So Owen's a whole nother, it's completely separate from dynamic kind of web service runtime things.
Yeah.
It's more like Rack from the Ruby world.
it's more of an interoperability layer. So you have the ability to put middleware in. That's kind of where I was going with the pipeline question earlier. It's not only can you add stuff like formatters in web API, but the pipeline behind the page, but in front of the page, you could add in, you know, caching or OAuth kind of middleware, the same way that you do in RAC applications. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to push, and we've got a 1.0 spec out there. And you should really look at getting it involved, because we've got a lot of the we, I say, as if, you know, I'm doing something other than listening on calls. But we've got a lot of support from inside Microsoft and from the community. And I think it's going to be a really good thing overall for .NET in the web space.
Definitely, definitely. I'll take a look at Owen.
And don't be scared by the giant delegate.
Yeah, I think it was mentioned in your last podcast with the Nancy FX guys.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about as much as I know about it.
Yeah, and one other thing they mentioned too, and it's reminding me, is async support. Is that something that you've had to worry about, or is it something, or since you're just kind of running on top of MVC, async is just kind of like whatever the supporting platform runs?
Yeah. Oak doesn't try to create its own controllers or anything. So the controller requests, all the handling of, you know, the HTTP requests is still handled by MVC. So when you're on Oak, you're good to go.
So we had a question from Bobby Johnson on Twitter, and he asked what strategies you use to limit the viral nature of the dynamic keyword from infecting the rest of your code base. So the
it sounds like it's such a bad thing.
I know, it's funny. But I mean, obviously there's kind of a, you know, good and bad side to it or whatever, but right. Do you find that, you know, once you start using dynamic, it's everywhere throughout your code, or, and is that a problem, or you know, can you interface if you're working with maybe some existing code that's not all dynamic, you know, can the two interoperate? Can they all get along?
Yeah, they can definitely get along. That's one great thing about the dynamic construct in .NET is that it can still interopt with statically typed things. Another thing is that your viral dynamic stuff won't be able to make it into the base common libraries anyways, because you can't inherit from Gemini on something that already inherits from something else. So your dynamic constructs will be constrained to just your objects. Another thing is that I understand that there's a definite benefit to having the compiler and type safety from a static language. And that's why I put so much emphasis on trying to mitigate that risk by having the feedback loops and the testing and things like that. So that's kind of the best answer I can give there, is that there is inherent risk to using dynamic. You'll find that you write significantly less code, and you can use that time to actually mitigate the risk by having a good test suite or just augmenting, you know, Rake scripts or the IIS Express console to give you a lot of that information. And dynamic's okay. It's all good.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, like we've been talking about, you know, JavaScript on the client, as people get more familiar with that, you know, then hopefully you can see the benefits of it on the server.
Yeah, and you know, the best correlation I can think of also is that I mean, we've been doing quote unquote dynamic things for a while, you know, with data sets. That's something that every .NET developer did, right? We would have data tables and data sets, and we would use dictionary based string stuff. We kind of lose type safety on our URLs. When you do url.route URL and you pass a new controller action, the anonymous type isn't really type checked, right? Because you can misspell that property and end up with something that doesn't compile to a URL. So what may end up happening is that as you start using more dynamic capabilities, you'll find that the static type checking that you did have really wasn't there, or may have gotten in the way sometimes. Even with the database, you have your entity framework model or your code first model. What if your schema is, you know, not in sync? So you have a database column that's named one thing, but your property is named another thing. You really didn't get any type safety there, or the type safety didn't really buy you anything. And I think that's what you start realizing when you start using more of the dynamic capabilities of C#.
Yeah, that's true. People think of static as, you know, having some certainty over what's going on. But as you're pointing out, the web is uncertain, the database is uncertain. You know, even if all your code was statically checked and typed and everything, it's doesn't tell you that everything's safe.
Yeah, and all your controllers return action result. If you're going to do that, just might as well return dynamic and type a few less characters, right?
Yeah. Scott?
It's all about saving those characters. And
all
more
about
to,
characters.
To Mr. Robert Johnson's point, if you want to talk about viral infections, let's talk about Task of T. try writing an async class without, you know, putting task of T everywhere. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Scott?
I think this is a fascinating project. I've just been browsing through the code for like the last hour and finding all sorts of interesting tidbits, how to do the composition. And
I'm really enjoying looking through the code, actually. It's not often, ooh, this is kind of fun. But yeah, this is a really nice code base. I'm learning lots just looking at it about how to use dynamic. And I've avoided it so far because I'm so used to dynamic on the JavaScript side that it kind of feels like, oh yeah, this is dynamic-ish when I'm in C#, as mm-hmm. opposed to, yeah, I'm just going to change everything on this whole thing altogether, and everything is open. Whereas in dynamic and C#, you still got this weird type, and you have to pass it around, and it's like, I never know when to use it versus when to use just an expando. I'm right. just going to use expando.
This thing replaces expando. Don't use expando anymore.
I just stick with VB6 variants. Those seem to work fine as long as you turn option explicit off.
Yes.
Yes.
Variant arrays of strings and string arrays of variants.
So one interesting thing about Gemini is that any dynamic methods that you create or any properties that you create are actually case insensitive. That was a deliberate choice I made, and it made it really easy for, you know, again, JSON payloads, title casing versus camel casing, all that just flowed together with these dynamic objects. And if you're creating properties or methods that differ only by case, we got other problems.
Well, all right. I'm kind of running out of things to talk about. Are there any areas that we skipped over or things you want to talk about in more detail?
I think the best way to try out Oak is to go ahead and do the interactive tutorial. You do need to have Ruby installed. I know that can feel like a barrier for some developers, but it's literally a two-minute install. It takes longer to open up Visual Studio than it does to install Ruby. And then after you install that, there's five commands that you run. You run the warm-up, rake server, and when you start up your solution and go to port 3000, you have an interactive tutorial that you can just try it out. And go through the schema generation, go through, it actually creates a blogging app. So you can create a blog and that adds comments and everything. And you'll be surprised at how quickly you're up and running and all the information that you get out of the system with very little code. And then, of course, go through the sample apps.
Yeah, you've got a lot of sample apps, and you also, uncharacteristic of a lot of GitHub projects, you've got a ton of documentation in the wiki too.
Yes, lots of documentation on this. Yeah,
and the screencasts too are really good. You've got some, you know, pretty well put together screencasts that walk through.
Yep.
So
it's been working on it for over a year now. So wow. I've been hacking on this for a while.
Okay, so what's next? What are you looking at adding onto Oak next, or what's just next for you in general?
So better story for single page applications. A better understanding of, you know, doing things like file uploads, adding dynamic to things like Service Stack, to Nancy, exploring those aspects of it, and then growing the number of Gemini modules that are out there. So there's just a chain tracking validation, associations are just a few of them. There's a couple more that are part of Cambium, but just trying to educate more people on how to create modules so you can start expanding these Gemini objects yourself.
Sorry, just thought of a question. I'm just curious whether you've done any investigation as to the impact of the heavily dynamic based architecture on performance.
So funny thing was that there's actually a test in there in my suite that hydrates 100,000 Anhibernate objects and does the same thing with dynamic runtime. And dynamic is slower if you're looking at straight compiled code. It's negligible, but it is slower. But what I found is that things with such as retrieving data from a database, reflection is actually slower than dynamic. And that's because you're dealing with reflection and then boxing and unboxing those properties. With a dynamic, you're just hydrating those objects and slamming them right into a dictionary. So it actually ends up being almost 2.5 times faster than Anhibernate to hydrate those 100,000 records. So it's really nice. And the same thing with JSON serialization and model binding. You're using a lot of reflection to try to hydrate those properties out. And unless you're using something like FastReflect to get that additional speed, you'll find that just slamming them into a dynamic object is actually faster.
Okay, Amir, do you have any speaking things or anything you'd like to talk about in the Pimp Your Stuff section of the podcast?
So, yes, definitely check out Oak. Follow me on Twitter. Amir Rajan is my Twitter handle. And Matt Florence and I, we both are the authors of NSpec, which is a testing framework that that's used by Oak and part of the continuous testing. And there's a podcast with Hanselman on NSpec that you definitely want to check out if you want. And, you know, reply to me on Twitter. I'm usually pretty quick about answering any questions. And, of course, any feedback that you can give on the project would be great. I accept pull requests, right?
Which reminds me, I do need that theme music for We Accept Pull Requests.
Yes.
All right. Okay, well, I think with that, well, let's wrap up. So thanks a bunch for your time this week, Amir.
No problem. It was fun.
All right. Yeah, and I definitely enjoyed looking at the code, as did everyone else. Really interesting project, and thanks.
Take care.
All right.
Bye.
That's it this week for Herding Code, and we'll talk to you again soon on Herding Code for the Herding Code podcast.